You're listening to the Miniature Podcast. My name is Ryan, and I'm the Useless Wizard. Today's guest is Seth Amsden. Seth is an incredible artist and competition painter. The amount of detail that he puts into his dioramas, in his landscapes, as well as just regular miniatures, is absolutely amazing. His attention to building the effects of time and subconscious triggers into his projects is astounding. Enjoy the interview. Welcome back to the Miniature Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. Today's guest is Seth Amsden. How's it going, man?
Great, thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to come onto the podcast.
Oh, I mean, it's an opportunity to talk about painting. I would not pass it down.
Awesome. Well, I'm hoping that we get to learn some cool insights from your journey. And just because you are quite an accomplished miniature artist, like a lot of people we've been able to talk to so far. And I know that there's not always a broad forum for you to just be able to talk about how you started, things like that, as opposed to individual pieces of work. So I'm excited for this conversation.
Fantastic. Me too.
So how did you start painting miniatures?
It was, now I'm going to date myself. It was in the mid 80s. I was playing Dungeons and Dragons at the local public library, and we would meet like every other Sunday. And one day I went in to play Dungeons and Dragons, and they weren't playing Dungeons and Dragons. They were playing Space Marine. And I'm talking about like the old epic Warhammer 40K Space Marine. And the whole thing just kind of pulled me in. The little old guys, the like the Titans, the tiny little tanks, the cardboard buildings. And I just remember having such a great time and wanting to find out more. And, you know, starting to, once you walk into a model shop for the first time, it kind of like, it's overwhelming. And there was just so many things. I was like, I want all the toys. And I started like playing at first, it was playing, but pretty quickly the models and the hobby aspect of it just kind of took over. And I've been branching out from there ever since.
That's awesome. So what was it about the painting that really grabbed you away from just playing the games?
It wasn't even so much the painting, because these models were tiny.
Like, okay.
You know, these are the, like,
the epic scale, like, what is it, 6mm or something?
6mm, yeah. But it was the Adrian Smith artwork inside. Okay. The books, and like seeing the pictures and getting pulled in, and then following that up by reading that like super like old gothic 40K style lore. Mm-hmm. Right. I just wanted more, and like it really exploded my imagination. I've always had an overactive imagination.
Okay.
And it was just kind of like fuel for that. Like, all the other science fiction that I had read up to that point had been so clean and so like pure.
Sure.
And there was something gritty and dark about the 40K lore that really opened my mind to new things.
Okay. Awesome. So at what point did you start diving into the actual painting and modeling? I mean, you went from gaming to just being completely inspired by all the artwork, all the lore. What was that transition to painting and trying to push your own skills? What caused that transition?
I was one of the youngest people in that group.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I would show up with my stuff, and it would either be like plastic or really rudimentary painting. And I'd look like what all the older guys were doing and listen to them talk about their stuff that they had done, and be like, oh, I want to be that good. And I've always had like a artistic inclination. So a lot of drawing and painting as a kid. So I just kind of threw myself into it. And then I found very quickly that like the teeny little epic stuff just wasn't doing it. And I started just going into stores and buying random miniatures for whatever. And pretty soon it wasn't even like any game in mind. It was just like, this is really cool. I want to try and paint this. And then reading like the old heavy metal little paint guides with like Mike McVeigh and John Butch, and like seeing their stuff and thinking, wow, that blows my mind. Look at those colors. And basically trying to imitate that. It's funny. I've got at one of my stores in Mountain View, California, there's a next to the register, there's like this little original Warhammer. I think it's like second or third edition. It was Ravening Hordes. It was like a Chaos Dwarf. And he's painted with like nail polish and tester's enamels. And he's got like this like black guy liner around his eyes.
Yeah.
And he's got like goblin green base. And it's totally all non-ironic. And I was classic. Like, yeah, that was so good.
That's awesome. But where do you find your inspiration when you're painting now?
Wow. All over the place. I mean, inspiration is a very interesting thing, and it can teach you a lot about the artist that you're looking at or yourself. I like to look at like artists, traditional artists who give me inspiration and their painting. Maybe it's somebody like or contemporary, like Alan Lee. I don't know if you know who Alan Lee is. He's the gentleman who did all of the watercolor paintings for like all of the Tolkien books.
And Lord of the Rings.
Yes. And then looking at like, where does he draw his inspiration from?
Mm.
And then kind of going backwards in time until you hit something really cool, like the Brotherhood of the Pre-Raphaelite Painters, who are English painters, including people like John William Waterhouse. And you look at like their use of color and story and how they show beauty by evoking emotion.
Okay.
And so I like this kind of stuff. And then, I mean, a lot of times I like to do like a lot of natural things. So I find a lot of inspiration in just the world around us and the little things that people tend to ignore.
Yeah, I've seen examples of a lot of your diorama and basing work, and just the detail that you put into the foliage and the soil, and just the background, kind of the background for the miniature, is just amazing. Is your attention and your inspiration from nature kind of the driving force behind that, or is it just more of a desire for true realism?
Both. It is definitely a driving force behind that. And I do like realism. I want to create something realistic and have it be fully immersive. And I think that like, I could go on and on and on. My big thing when I'm trying to create something that's real is trying to get the like subconscious triggers, the unconscious triggers that are things that your brain sees, but your eyes don't.
Okay.
Right. And that's why you'll find a lot of those details crammed into like my diorama and my work and my basing, and my landscapes. Right. And the inspiration definitely comes from nature and spending the time to like actually look at those things and see what your brain is seeing with your eyes and process, put it all together. And you're like, wow, that's just like a little patch of grass in somebody's sidewalk that's overgrown. But like, look at how the wind has blown it, and you can see where the dog has gone through it, and the little bits of leaf litter stuck into the grass. It's telling me like which way the wind was blowing.
Mm.
I mean, it actually will make me think of a story when I see something like that. And when my brain starts working in that way and I start concocting stories, this is where inspiration comes from.
That's fantastic. So do you come up with these, the stories as you need them, or do you kind of plan out as much of the diorama and as much of the story as possible first?
I plan out like as much of the story and the diorama first, but inspiration is fickle, mm-hmm. right? You start working and you start doing something, and if it's like one of those projects that really have like your creative juices flowing or lit a fire underneath you, like I'll go to bed and then I'll wake up in the middle of the night because you know what? I need to do this. And so it does change as you go, but the main story, the main theme never changes. It's just finding the best path to tell that story.
Awesome. That's really interesting. It's just, there's so much thought that you put into these projects that I think a lot of people, you know, they don't, especially when we're starting out, like people like me, when I'm starting out, I don't put that much thought in, but hearing the storytelling power that you are lending, things like tufts of grass, all these tiny little details, it's really inspiring. So I appreciate that.
And well, thank you. And I was going to say, there's times where, you know, like some artists have sketchbooks, mm-hmm. right? And I can laugh and just say I have unfinished projects, but there's definitely times where I'll have a strong flash of inspiration, mm-hmm. and very much in a similar matter to somebody who grabs their sketchbook and draws something out, I'll grab my, you know, my sculpting and my basing materials, and I'll build basically a sketch of what I want to do.
Okay.
Put it off to the side. A lot of times when I put something off to the side and don't keep working on it, it's because I know that there's something in that, like some component that I don't know how to do yet. All right. And this usually involves making things up, which I love to do as well. Play with fire.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, play with fire, see what burns.
Mm-hmm.
Do you... I know a lot of people recommend, especially a lot of, you know, very dedicated painters and commission painters, when they're talking about, you know, remembering paint recipes and things like that, they actually keep a painting journal. Do you keep something similar to that? Or is it just, or is it not just, but is it a whole bunch of sculpt sketches, I guess we might call them?
Yeah, I have a bunch of sculpts of like my unfinished projects. I would say that like in my big case where I have mm-hmm. a lot of my things, at least two shelves are filled with these like half starts of things where I'm like, I gotta put this idea down.
Okay.
Before like I lose it completely. 'Cause there's something about details and, you know, conveying things, like I said, through those details that even if you remember the main like story you're trying to impart, you'll forget some of those little details. So gotcha. I definitely do that. And as for like paint formulas, nah.
No.
No book of formulas. If you saw the way that I will start painting, you'd probably be like, what the hell is he doing?
But that's the most interesting. Like if you look at people like Richard Gray or Bohun, two people that I've just recently started following, the way they paint is confusing to me because it's not formulaic at all. And right. they still end up with these amazing looking projects. So I fully believe that, you know, you might have an eccentric way of painting, but the results speak for themselves. So I'd just be sitting there like looking like, this is absolutely incredible. I don't understand what's happening, but... Yes. It's magic. You're a wizard.
That's what I'm saying, right? And it's funny because in my head, like I've kind of divided creative people into two very like different distinct groups, mm-hmm. right? And there's what I call living inside the bubble of purity.
Okay.
And then there's people who are without, right, who are outside. And it's like the difference between ordered in chaos, right? Because there are some artists who are extremely like methodical in their approach. Everything has to be like beautiful and pristine and crisp and, you know, it is flawless NMM and reflections, and like the model or the subject just seems to glow, right? But that subject exists apart from reality in a lot of times, right? Like, here's this gorgeous space marine and he's on the battlefield and there's like all this destruction around him, right? And there's not one dot of dust on him. Like, it just can't touch him, right? And it's like this idealized, beautiful, like, form
sure.
of representation, like heroic representation of action. And it makes me think of like neoclassic paintings, mm-hmm. like, you know, the coronation of Napoleon or something, where it is not what really happened, but like
right.
absolute ideal of it.
Yeah.
And then there's the people who live outside the bubble, and they've given up that kind of precision and that regularity for like the random chaotic nature, like nature and natural processes. Like, somebody who's inside the bubble has a really hard time doing those chaotic things without a lot of concentration, and vice versa. Right? True.
Absolutely.
I'll talk about some of my friends who do freehand. And their freehand is gorgeous, but then they'll do something like sculpt a tree or like, you know, paint stones or, you know, something like that. And every like segment is perfect and regular, and it loses something there. Whereas like somebody like me, I start like a nice freehand, and like halfway down, I'm like, oh my God, it's getting bigger. I'll just do this. It's okay. But like, I don't think that my brain wants to make those regular patterns anymore.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I can totally see that. And that seems to be, I don't know. I would say that seems to be separate from the quote unquote American versus quote unquote European styles of painting. I think European tends to just, you know, do the same type of thing. You've got those two different types of people, but the color saturation and things like that are very different to the American, because I can mentally, I see a bunch of different miniatures that I've seen that are both that are American style and fit into those two paradigms, and also European ones that fit into both of those paradigms. So it seems like you've kind of discovered or defined a different way of looking at the miniature painting world. Do you see any, I don't know, advantage or disadvantage to studying one or the other? Or should someone who's really wants to get into it really focus on one or the other as a building block?
That's interesting. First of all, I'm going to get on my soapbox and
okay.
say there's no right way to art.
Right? I agree.
Art is art is art is art. Can you gain benefit from studying both? Absolutely. Right. And I would say the person who can do both of them really, really well, and there's definitely a good amount of artists who can, those are the people I look up to.
Okay. Right?
But this is, this is not a thing about like studying. This is a thing about what kind of creative, what kind of artist you are.
Okay.
Right? I tell my students all the time, like, study everything. Don't just listen to me. If you just listen to me, you're going to miss out on so much information. And you pick up pieces from everybody that you come in contact with. You get all of these like external sources and pluses and level ups from, you know, everybody you come in contact with. And then one day you just kind of find your own voice. Once you find your own voice, there's no, you can try to go against it and do something else and be like, no, I really still can paint like this. And then you try to do it and you're like, it either just doesn't like feel right to you. It's not a fulfilling project. It ends up getting rushed. It ends up like, you know, you end up messing things up and getting frustrated with it. And it's because you're not doing you. So at the end of the day, how do you end up in one of those groups? By being you and following the brushstrokes and the vision that you have. Once you kind of see, I'm definitely going this way with the way that I approach my creativity, my art, then looking to the greats in those kind of different divisions and studying what they do is what I recommend. Right? Okay. Take from everybody in the beginning until you can figure out what you want to do.
Okay, so steal from everyone you can until you find what speaks to you and what works for your style.
Exactly.
Okay. So is there a concept or technique in painting that really kind of defines your particular style in your own mind? It can be color choice, or it doesn't even have to be a technique, but just a concept or approach.
I would say I strive for realism and realistic, like to imitate natural processes and nature. Just because it's a natural process, it doesn't mean that like it's not man-made, or you know what I'm saying? There's things like, you're getting me all stumbled up. I'm so excited. I'm like, it's about those subconscious triggers and finding that realism and trying to make the viewer like suspend their disbelief, doing something whimsical to remind them that it's fancy.
Okay. That's really cool. I can just hear the excitement in your voice of talking about it. It's really awesome to hear.
I like things like the concept of it. I might be jumping ahead here. I'm sorry. But like the concept of something like a natural history museum display, right? Where you would have like the animals in their natural environment and recreating that as realistically as possible, and then removing the natural animal and replacing it with something like mechanical. But worn correctly so it fits the environment, but it's the right thing, but it's the wrong thing. All right.
And yeah. It creates
a little bit of surrealism, and it's like juxtaposition that kind of, it feels right, but it pushes against your brain.
So when you describe that, I'm automatically brought back to imagining the cover art for the board game Scythe. You've got all these wonderful pastoral scenes of peasants in fields in Europe, but then there's this giant smoke billowing mech off in the distance, but the texture's right, the color composition is right, and it matches with everything else. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
All right. So that's probably like the driving thing behind what I like, the driving theme behind the things that I like to do.
Okay. That's awesome. Have you ever had a eureka moment in kind of the development of your style?
Yeah. I mean, I've had a couple. One of them was a eureka moment, and it resulted in a piece that I was like super happy with. And then I took it to a painting competition and the judges tore me apart, which was followed by like a completely different type of epiphany. All right. And it all kind of ties into one. I'd been teaching a weekend seminar on like building natural scenes. Mm-hmm. And one of my friends it was around my birthday, and one of my friends had brought me a birthday present, and it was like one of those vinyl blank toys.
Okay. You know,
the little custom ones. And I remember I got home and I was unloading all of my stuff into my work area. And like I had all my basing stuff still out, and I took the vinyl toy and I kind of tossed it on the desk, and it kind of just rolled over and like hit the stuff. And I was like, hey, instead of like painting this like with graffiti or whatever, what if I made it into a rock?
Oh.
And like, so I took the vinyl toy and I took this perfectly smooth thing and created all this texture and wear and age and made it look like a stone statue that was like splitting and breaking and had like all these plants growing mm-hmm. out of it. And I was super happy with it. It was like the first time I'd done a piece that kind of expressed that thing that I would have been brewing in my mind. And I brought it to a painting competition, and like, a lot of the judges, they loved it, but one of the judges, he was just like absolutely hated it. And when I talked to him at the end, he was like, it just looks like a rock. Like, all you did was paint it to look like a rock. And I was like, all right, well, you know, kind of F you in your opinion, right? But like, that's interesting. And then for years, all I did was paint things to look like rocks. I mean, there were twists on it, right?
Sure.
Like, sure, this is a castle, but this is limestone. This is granite. This is, you know, like molten lava. This is – lava's not a rock. Excuse me. Yes, it is. It's just a liquid form, yeah. Right? Like, and just doing all these different things, and it kind of led me into this area where I started – once I started doing that kind of project, I started mm-hmm. doing a lot more research into like nature and science, and found that like I can pull a lot of that into my work as well.
That's a fantastic story. How many pieces do you think you did that were just rocks after that?
Maybe a dozen.
Okay. That's a lot.
But some of my personal favorite pieces are like from that. I think one of the crowning ones was when I revisited doing the vinyl toy, and I did this piece called Lost, and mm-hmm. it is like a vinyl money, and I cut out his inside of his face, and I painted Vincent Van Gogh's Starry Night in the back of his head in Dayglow paints, and built a little temple in there and put like Dayglow LEDs, and then used a pocket watch and made him into a lighthouse, built an entire cliff around him and made it look like he was falling in, like he'd been carved out of a cliff and the ocean was like crashing up at the bottom. And like, that's to me, like that's one of the few pieces that I would never sell, right? That's one of my horcrux.
It sounds fantastic. Are there pictures of that on your Instagram or anywhere?
Yeah, there are. Okay. It was a while back, but I still love that piece.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to have to see if I can find that, because I want people to see that, because that sounds incredible.
It combines some of my favorite things, which are, you know, this making natural textures and water and casting water or doing resin or
Awesome. So when you're sitting down to start a new project, what's kind of your first thing that you do?
Like after I've got my story, mm-hmm. I will then do like, and my components, I'll do my research. And your mind is a real tricky little guy. He likes to play tricks on you all the time. All right. You will think about it and you're like, I know what trees look like. Mm-hmm. And you'll go and do something and you're like, go back and look at the pictures later on. You're like, that's not what those trees look like. Right. And I think that we do this all the time. And this is where things start to fall apart in what we're doing, is because we are letting what our mind perceives reality to be to dictate how we try when we try to recreate reality, instead of doing the correct amount of research and then constantly going back and referencing your reference material. Because even if you do all the research ahead of time, you're like, I know this. The further a project progresses, or the longer the amount of time, that what you saw, you're seeing a completely different thing, right? Mm-hmm. That's mental, personal biases that you put into these things, and it is very, it makes it very difficult to maintain realism. So I will do a ton of research. I'll get all of my reference material. Usually when I'm creating an environment, it kind of self-dictates its color palette.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
Right. Because I choose an environment and I do all my research. I say, I want to create this environment at this time of year. This gives me my color palette. And then when I play with like making something pop or being surreal, then I will purposely jump outside of my like color gamut, out of my little, you know, tight palette, and introduce something that sticks out. So having that planned ahead of time, I think, is my first step.
I think that makes a lot of sense, just because I find when I am starting something new, if I don't do a lot of planning, I spend a huge amount of time just sitting there staring at the model rather than making progress, because I don't know where I'm going, or I have a very vague idea. So putting in a huge amount of planning, or at least a decent amount of planning, I think makes a lot of sense. You teach painting classes. Have you ever tried approaching newer painters and getting them to think in kind of that way, to emphasize planning? Has that gone well, or is that something you've done?
Well, remember when I talked about like the different type of people?
Yeah.
I am that chaotic chaos out there. I will roll up into a class and you never know what you're going to get.
Okay.
It's funny, and I, you know, I'm not trying to make myself look bad or whatever. I can teach the same class four times, and there's always variations.
Okay.
Do I always try to make people plan? Yes, but I don't. I think I spend more time harping on making yourself consciously competent instead of being unconsciously competent, and paying attention to what's around you and why things are the way they are, right? This is what goes back to that whole like subconscious trigger thing, right? Mm. When we first start painting, this is a tangent, sorry.
That's
when
okay. We first start painting,
one of our biggest goals is to become unconsciously competent.
Yep.
Right. When you pick up your first model and you're layering and you're trying to get those first blends in and everything, you're thinking about every single step that you make, every brushstroke that you make. And it causes a lot of hesitation and frustration, right? Your goal is to get to a point where you're doing everything and you're executing without thinking about it.
Yeah.
Right. This is a great thing, but this is a dangerous thing. Right. You get to a certain point where you've got everything down. You've got to get that like plus one, that level up, that new technique, that new piece of information. And you have to bring it into your work. Right. And at that point in time, you have to break yourself of being unconsciously competent, and you need to be consciously competent again. And this is a process we repeat over and over and over again in, you know, the time that we paint. It is something that we think about, but we don't think about. what I try to harp on is we should, yes, we want to get muscle memory mm-hmm. when it comes to painting, but we want to stay always consciously competent. You want to think about what you're doing and why you're doing it. It's key. You can miss so much when you're not thinking about what you're doing and you're just letting your muscle memory go. Mm-hmm. You get to a certain point, you're like, oh, it'd be really cool if I did this. Well, I skipped like three steps. There's no way I can go back and do this. And it's too late to add in sometimes something that would end up like some little narrative bit or technique that would have end up completely selling the story that you're trying to tell. All right. And you miss out on those things when you don't consciously think about what you're doing. So when I start classes, this is what I always kind of like, you need to be consciously competent. You need to, yes, organization is key, but you can't have that organization, or you can't even have like, you know, getting all that reference material and getting everything started if you're not thinking about those things to begin with. If you're just jumping into a project, right? And like, I just grab the model and I go, you skip that on that whole step. The first step is to be consciously competent.
That makes sense? Yes. I think that makes a lot of sense, and it I think it really kind of displays the difference between artists who can teach and artists who have a very difficult time teaching. The ones that have a difficult time teaching or communicating what they do strike me as not as being very unconsciously competent, and they're just kind of naturally going on, this is what I know I want to happen, and they're not being conscious about it, which means they're not quite breaking down everything that they're doing so that they can communicate that. And I think that's something that a lot of really advanced painters find themselves in, and definitely a lot of beginning painters and intermediate painters like myself, we want to get to that point where I just don't even have to think about wet blending, you know, I just do it. But I think what you just said is really good, because if we're on autopilot, you're not necessarily, you're going to miss windows of opportunity, but B, you're not even being self-critical about what you're doing. So how are you going to get better if you're just on autopilot? No airline pilot gets to be a better airline pilot by just using autopilot all the time. Right?
Right.
I think that's exactly. I think that's a really good perspective. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you're welcome. And it's funny that you mentioned like teaching, because when I like how some teachers get on that autopilot, mm-hmm. I know, and the reason that I start with this is I know I do this sometimes when I'm teaching, right? And I always say that I am at the point where sometimes something will happen, because it is just that unconsciously competent, and I might lose some of you. You might like, that's magic. What just happened at that point in time, you have to break me and say, what happened? You know, stop, show me what you just did. And that I like getting that from students, because then I'm like, Oh, I never even thought about that. Why, you know, I never even thought about it including or explaining this step, but obviously it's a critical thing to do. And I think that helps me become a better teacher as well.
That's really good insight. Do you find that when you try to be very consciously competent when you're teaching, that you... Do you find that it allows you to cover more material or less material in a class? So just for somebody who's trying to decide on how much material to put in a class.
I am. Yes, it does. I can get broader subjects. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I can only give a little bit about each thing.
Sure.
It's because I know that there's this rabbit hole where once I start talking about weathering, we need to get into erosion, which goes into, you know, knowing how a watershed works, which is what's the geological strata made out of, and which way did the rooster crow this morning. It's one of those things. So what I try to do is I don't know if it works as an instructor. My students like it, but sometimes when I do this, I don't get like tons of attendance for classes.
Okay.
Instead of doing something like, oh, I'm going to teach you weathering 101, I will be like, the process, my class will be like the process of erosion and chemical, you know, chemical wear. Right? People are like, what the F is this?
That is very accurate. A marketing director would lose their mind on that. They're just like, no, that's not, no.
You can't do that.
Yeah.
But I, like, in my head, I'm thinking, this is such a important thing to,
absolutely,
like, teach a class. And, like, I want to give you this information, but I want to make sure that I actually, when I say I'm going to give you a master class, I'm going to give you a master class.
Yeah.
Right? I'm going to give you the techniques. I'm going to give you the science. I'm going to give you the why. I'm going to give you how to recreate this. And hopefully I'm going to teach you how to not just paint something, but change somebody's perception. And if it's only for something like erosion, when you actually put it in and you start to realize that, like, this affects everything, that's when I'm like, okay, I did a really good class. Could I get, you know, better attendance by teaching something less specific? Absolutely. But I wouldn't be able to convey the same kind of lesson. And I find that all the times where I try to open it up to a broader subject, let me not just teach, you know, moving water. Let me just teach water in general. It's like the class is, you get 20 minutes of good information here. I already knew this, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. Right.
So what you're saying is when people see your classes on, you know, a schedule, they should find the scariest sounding ones and go to those.
Probably. Right. Because I'm going to show you something that is not just a technique. I'm gonna give you the reasoning and the science and everything behind it as well. All right. I'm not gonna give you just the how to do it. I'm gonna give you the why.
Yeah.
You do
exactly
it.
And that's the type of stuff that really helps me, because I'm a very analytical painter. Like, when I approach art and color theory and things like that on a very analytical level, I'm not someone who's just inspired, like, these colors look good together, and, you know, I'm able to do that. I have to know the whys. So I definitely appreciate that type of approach. But I can totally see why attendance would be low in those, because it's very intimidating. It's like, I want to play plastic. I want to paint plastic spacemen. I don't need to know the detailed oxidation, you know, lifetime of copper, so I know how much verdigris to put in.
But if you want to make that space marine,
in a
situation where he's going through a temple that is a certain age, you have to know that.
Yep, I know. I agree. If you want to be able to get that perfect, it's something you need to know. But I don't think I see why a lot of people would be intimidated by that. I'd be excited, but.
I mean, I've been playing around with it for a lot of years, and I wanted to teach a class just on the importance of those, like, subconscious triggers, and I just wanted to call it bird poop. Because I'm pretty sure that if I put, like, you know, bird shit, they would take it out of every convention.
Most likely. I've seen some that were things like blood, gore, piss, and pus. So if those went through, I'm sure you'd be fine. But I think a class on those hyper details, those subconscious triggers, would be really interesting for people wanting to push their basing game and their diorama and their competitive entry game.
Absolutely. And bird poop. Can we have a moment for bird poop?
Absolutely.
Like, bird poop is so important.
It is. I'm going to go on a little tangent here. I don't know if you saw it last year at Adepticon, but there was a bust of, it was a War Machine character. It's like the Pirate Queen. And she was mounted on a group of wooden poles that were bound together and like stained to look like they were like part of a pier or something.
Yep.
And the artist, we were hanging out super late at night, and he decided he needed to add something. So he did the most amazing speck of bird poop on that, and it tied everything together. It was insane.
I mean, a little bit of salt crusting.
Yeah.
Some bird poop, right? And maybe a barnacle. This is what you need to sell something like that. And they're like, I can almost smell the ocean.
Right.
Right. It's knowing that you can get a tea kettle and put salt water in it and boil it, and then take your base and put it into the steam, and then hair dry it, and continually do this to build up your own salt crystals. It's getting a little bit of your titanium white oil paints and putting that little smudge of bird poop on there, but then taking it one step further and dipping your brush, your oil paint brush, into a little turquoise weathering powder and smudging just a little dot of turquoise into the middle of that white.
Yep.
Right. And that kind of little teeny details, those two small steps, right, are the things that sell the reality. It makes, those are the things that your brain expects to see, but your eyes don't see or don't always see. Bird poop is something that we don't think about and we try to push out of our head. But go to a city. Find me a statue that's not clean every few hours, that isn't covered in bird poop, all right? Or the top of a facade of a building, or go on and on and on and on and on about these things. But people leave these out. And it's the difference between realism and the uncanny valley.
Okay. I think that's a really cool way of putting it, because we keep thinking of things like the new Cats movie when it comes to things like the Uncanny Valley. It's close to being real, but there's something wrong. And I think what you're saying is those types of subconscious trigger details really help push it up the other side of the Uncanny Valley into things aren't as wrong. It's not as disturbing or uncomfortable to look at.
Right. Or it makes your brain accept that, yeah, this is right, until it notices something that's wrong. It makes that little piece of wrong even more disturbing and uncanny, which then evokes a strong emotional response in your viewer, which as an artist is the goal.
Yeah.
If you can make somebody else feel something or see something, like make up a story in their head, become attached to your piece. I mean, that's better than any award that anybody can give to you ever, right? Having somebody come up and said, like, say after a show, when I look at this piece, I get this real sense of like melancholy and I feel sad. And this is why. And it reminds me of this. And I'll sit there and I'll listen and I'm like, that's what I'm talking about right there. That's what I want to do.
What's something you want to try with a miniature project, but you're hesitant to try?
How do you capture the wind?
Ooh.
I mean, that's definitely one. I've got lots of ideas. How would you do OSL underwater? I could go on and on and on. A lot of these are based off of like these sketches that I have sitting off to the side, right? Where it's like, oh, in order for this to work, I need to be able to sell this effect. And some things like showing the wind. I have idea. It's scary to do. I mean, I don't want to just like make it so you've got like a strand of leaves that are barely touching each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that doesn't do it. That doesn't sell the wind, right? And how do you do dust? Like floating dust?
Ooh.
Like a cloud that's not just a cotton ball that's been puffed out. Do you make everything in a solid resin ball? I mean, part of my brain says that this might be the solution. And then, have you ever seen the way that it, this is another tangent? But have you ever seen the way a Vietnamese jelly cake is made?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they take like this jelly and they get like the little blades and they stuff the color into it.
Mm-hmm.
If I could put some sort of like powder in a syringe and inject that into resin. Do you see what I'm saying? At different cure times, then I could stick it into a resin ball, start to squeeze out, even if it was, let's say I wanted to do something like Tinkerbell, and she's got like the little fairy dust behind her, putting a pearlescent ink into a syringe, and then putting it into partly cured resin, and then lightly depressing while threading the tip of the needle through resin to create that kind of effect. Could I do that with some sort of dust without it becoming wet? Or like OSL underwater is a very similar, the reason I mentioned those two, my thought process on how I'd approach it is kind of the same, where if I paint everything to look like it's glowing and then I pour my colored resin, wait until it's at a certain cure point, then take a syringe filled with clear resin, stick it down to the glowing object, and displace my colored fluid with clear fluid.
Hmm.
Then perhaps that could create that effect too. So those are the type of things that I'm hesitant to try. And non-metallic metals, but don't tell anybody I said that.
Yeah. I think a lot of people have said that. A lot of people have said non-metallic metals. Those are all really interesting. I don't know how you would do that.
You figure it out. I got $10,000 for you.
I'm not that smart.
I mean, it's just about like experimenting and ruining things and then trying again.
Yeah. But what's the biggest challenge you've faced as a miniature painter?
Landscapes are not bases.
Okay.
If I make you a landscape and give it to you as a gift in a little picture frame, please don't tell me that you know exactly which miniature you want to put on it. You want to see me rage? Oh, it's getting acceptance for these concepts that are outside of our accepted norm, mm-hmm. but are an accepted part of regular art.
There does seem to be a lot of friction between that. And there's definitely a lot of artists, miniature artists, who want to bridge that gap. But there just, for some reason, there just seems to be a lot of almost quote unquote institutional resistance to doing that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's different and people don't understand. It's something that is all of a sudden, you know, it's no longer just models, it's art. And some people, some people don't get it, some people get it, right? But I think it's opening up everybody's eyes and showing them that it doesn't have to be just gaming or modeling, it's 100% art. It's the expression of the person who's doing it, right? And I think one of the hardest things to do, and why it hasn't gained as much traction as a movement like this could, is when you buck those, like, those accepted norms, you meet a lot of backlash. You start doing something that's different, and people, like, you're met with resistance. People don't understand, why are you doing this? How can you have a diorama if there's no models on it, right? But why? Why does it have to have models? Does this not tell you a story, right? And it's, I think that's been one of the biggest challenges that I've faced as a miniature painter. Because I want to make miniature landscapes.
You want to make that a thing? It sounds like you already have. But
I try.
Okay. Oh. What's been your biggest disappointment or failure on a project, and how did you recover from that?
I didn't recover from it.
Okay.
I'm still immersing the hurt deep down inside. A few years back for the Crystal Brush, I had this fantastic idea, and I wanted to do this piece that was like a woman standing in a doorway. It was basically, it was a Kingdom Death figure where it was just the naked lady with the lantern. Right. And I made this like run down dilapidated, like castle doorway that was in like overgrown in the forest. Right. And I wanted to do this really complex lighting, and it decided to experiment in how I was going to approach this. And I decided I was going to go like the Caravaggio route and put like a lot of these deep greens in. And I just, even though I know better than, and to be careful about my interactions with colors, I completely like muted my color palette at the last by adding in the wrong interaction. And it took all the nuance out of it and just made it look flat. And then I was in my hotel room trying to like force things back out. And I didn't give myself enough time to get down to the before deadline. And so I was rushing down to enter the piece. And I get up to the where you submit the piece, and I dropped it. And the woman on the piece shattered. And I had like 10 minutes.
My hands
were shaking so bad, and I got the tweezers out, glued it back together, and then I artfully like glued a little leaf over the snap, and then I looked at the scratches that like happened to like different places, and I had to like put some really hard drop shadows in, and I was just inside, I was crying.
Oh man.
But I entered it, and you know, it made final cut. And a lot of people liked it. A lot of people hated it. I also learned something very important that year, that those color interactions aren't just, especially for a contest like the Crystal Brush, it's not just what's in my piece. It's the background as well. So then they took this piece that was already muted because of some of my color, like too much olive and, you know, basically the way that I did it, and they put it on this light blue background.
Oh.
And it just, whoosh, it looked like I barely painted it.
All the subtleties gone. It just completely desaturated.
Yep. And this is where I was like, oh, okay. Well, wow. Next year I'm going to paint something gray with like a really bright, vibrant green backdrop. and then put in some turquoise, and that's going to pop like hell. And then the next year I did the AT-AT, and I thought it photographed really well.
That's like, interesting.
I was like, I mastered you, background.
And then they changed the background color. Like, no!
No! But they never did change the background color. No. And this is why things like Space Wolves always look great in the Crystal Brush.
Oh, yeah. Because you've got those blues and those teals and those kind of cyans and just all of that stuff that works so well against that.
Yeah. So it was an interesting learning lesson. Know what competition you're painting for. All right. Doesn't mean you have to change what you're doing, but you definitely need to consider things like it's going to be photographed and this is the color of the background.
Okay. Do they usually put the color of the background? Did they put that in the painting rubric at all? Or did you just have to ask?
No, I just went and found out.
Okay.
Right? And then I was like, oh, I'm going to do this differently.
Okay. So for anyone who's deciding to work on a painting competition ever, make sure to put the color of the background. If you're going to take photos, put the color of the backgrounds in the rubric so people can decide and paint for that. Because otherwise, you're going to be doing your painters a disservice.
If, you know, it's going to be posted online for part of your scoring.
What's something that you think you did amazingly well, but no one really noticed?
The cobwebs in the trees and bushes in the self-portrait that I did, I entered in the bust category of the Crystal Brush last year. I think that, like, it took my little forest and, like, the whole forest thing that I had done.
Mm-hmm.
And put it to a whole different level of realism, because you never go into a forest and see bushes without seeing cobwebs.
True.
All right. And the other thing that I think that I did really, really well that nobody seemed to notice is on that same piece is the trees that are around the bust are actually like skeletal fingers that make a hand that's closing in around my self-portrait.
Okay. I'm going to have to go back and look for these now. Because I think I remember seeing this piece, and I admittedly did not notice at least the trees. I think Bug King pointed out the cobwebs to me. But the fingers, I didn't notice that. I'm going to have to go back and look, see if I can find that.
It's just one of those things. I made it so if you look at it from one way, right, it's very inviting, but when you look at it from the other way, you can see it a lot more, and it's very cool and like menacing.
That's really cool. I like that. That idea of from one angle, it's beautiful, and a completely different angle, it's completely different. And I think that's something that can be very unique to miniatures and sculptures in particular.
Yeah, painting a three-dimensional object gives you lots of opportunities to hide those kind of subtleties and make those kind of transitions.
Awesome. But what's the biggest risk you've taken with a miniature project that's paid off for you?
The hollow box that I did on the AT-AT. I knew I wanted to have the seaweed and everything underneath the water flowing.
Yeah.
And I knew I couldn't do it if I had encapsulated in resin.
Sure.
But I wasn't 100% sure how I was going to get the top on and make it stick. And when I showed up to Adepticon, it was not assembled at all. And Ambrose sat there for 2 days and he watched me struggle. The Bug King sat there, watched me struggle with it. And, like, get the order of operations wrong.
Oh,
and,
man.
Like, you know, basically fly by the seat of my pants, because I had this idea that you can paint with light.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to do it. And then, you know, putting it down on the table and having one of the judges look at me and ask me how much it weighed.
Because they thought it was all resin.
Yeah, and I was like, I don't know, you pick it up. And they picked it up, and they're like, ah, you're cheeky. I was like, yeah.
And that would have
that was very satisfying.
That would have been a lot of resin.
It would have been a lot of resin. Those legs would have warped.
Oh, absolutely.
100%. Like, I wouldn't have been able to do it that way. And so, to get that kind of effect. So, I'd seen people filtering light and using films before to do it to good effect, but it was like I didn't understand how that effect was being achieved. It's more than just the like having it a hollow box. It's about removing certain colors from the light spectrum.
Okay. So filtering out the colors that would not normally be underwater.
Red.
Yeah.
At a depth of 10 feet, the red starts to go away. Right?
Yep.
And so using the correct colors in the painting of the stuff underneath, like putting the right kind of combination of greens and blues underneath, and then using the right colored film on top, so it made everything look like it was underwater. And if you took the box apart, it's not like there's two drastic different paintings. It's just a natural transition from one color palette to another. But when you filter out the light, it does the trick for you.
Interesting. For those of you who might be interested in seeing this, this is a diorama on his Instagram of an AT-AT wading through a river. And it's absolutely mind-blowing. So there will be a link for that in the show notes, but I highly recommend you go take a look at that, because it is... it's really impressive.
Thank you.
Not a problem.
Do fun stuff.
Yeah.
That's it.
So what's been the biggest triumph in your painting journey so far?
Biggest triumph? The success of my students.
Okay.
Seeing some of the people that I have helped and mentored for years go on to win competitions or, you know, things like accolades from like the Games Workshop community or, you know, any of these type of things. Seeing that they have then taken on their own students and begin to teach people, I think that's the biggest triumph. It's making sure that people get the support and then are passing on the support.
That's great. Ooh. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received regarding painting miniatures?
How much can I swear on this podcast?
Ideally, not that much, but I can beep things out.
All right. Well, when you start to get to a certain point in painting, you start to know so much. All right. And then with the way that my painting style has developed, where it's all about these subconscious triggers and all about these layers of details, there's so many different things out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was working on weathering a vehicle, and I was sharing some of the pictures with Matthew Fontaine, and he just was like, Seth, you are trying to f*** a fly from a mile away.
Wow.
And I was like, Well, what?
I don't know what that means.
Exactly. And I was like, what does that mean? And he was like, you're putting everything that you know, every technique, every little bit into this one piece. And it's too much.
Hmm. Okay.
My brain, my eyes, my brain and my eyes. Like, it's overload. And, okay. You know, you gotta hold back. And you gotta kind of, you know, show less, do less to have a bigger impact. I think that's really good advice, because I got into this point where I was like, the only way I'm going to impress anybody is if I do everything that I can possibly do. And then everything, it's so much noise. It's like a bunch of voices in a crowded room shouting out, me, 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 and nobody gets hurt. Right? And the funny thing is, I've always known this. And, you know, once again, I apologize for my non-PC way of saying things, but I've always said, like, you gotta be like a good stripper. You can't show everything. You have to hint, and you have to lead the imagination. You have to tease. And I'd so completely, like, I was on such a quest to impress, not any of my viewers, but like judges who are looking for technical skill, that I was putting everything into a bunch of the pieces that I did. And I go back and I look at that and I'm like, no wonder it was terrible. I hated those pieces. I spent too much time on it. I thought, God, I spent 40 hours just on the paint chips. Right?
Sure. And
at the end of the day, I wasn't satisfied because there was just too much competing with itself.
So how do you decide what techniques to limit yourself to when you're getting ready to start on a new competition piece?
How old is it?
What do you mean?
That's 100% how what is the age that I'm trying to tell?
Oh, okay.
How much time am I trying to convey? How old, how fresh is this piece? And then that tells me what I need to limit myself to. Because each different layer of time has different triggers.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay, you need to teach a class on these triggers, because now I really want to know.
That's fair.
I will sign up for that class as soon as I see it.
I think I will. I think it will call, you know, it's the bird poop class.
There you go. Yeah. Bird poop, subconscious triggers. Then people will be like, what?
What the hell? He's over there doing something funny again.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll be like, guys, it's a scary title. That means you need to go. That's what it means. When Seth has a scary title, that's something really important. All right. So what, now we're coming up on the end here, and I'm curious, what is it about miniature art that keeps you coming back? Why do you keep doing this particular, I almost want to say medium or format?
I've found that I can combine techniques from all of my favorite mediums into miniature art.
Okay.
I get to use oils and watercolors. I can be whimsical or I can be surreal. But it is a obsession for little small details that really brings me back. And the craftsmanship that goes into it. Right? I mean, I went to a craftsman school. So, like, building and crafting something is definitely a part of the way my brain works. And, you know, I'm working on a piece right now where it's like, oh, I want to have a tear in an airplane wing, in a spaceship wing. Right. And it's like, well, this needs to be hollow, so I need to chop off this huge resin chunk, and I need to build it out of plastic card, and I need to put all of the little struts in internal. Like, that's the type of thing that makes me tick. And will anybody know or realize, like, how much craftsmanship went into that torn wing? Mm-hmm. Probably not. But will they think that looks just like a torn airplane wing? Yeah. Hopefully so. All right.
That's a great answer. It's just the attention to detail, and yeah, it's what drives you. I've received a lot of answers like that, either from a mental health perspective or just a self-expression perspective. So I think that's turning out to be a good theme amongst a lot of the people I've talked to. It's just, it scratches an itch that nothing else does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. So now for the big question, if time and money were no option, like they were not a problem, what would your unicorn project be?
I mean, if time and no money were, and skill were no object.
Okay, yeah.
Right. Well, it would be just a blown up version of what is, like, currently my unicorn project, right? So, I think maybe 6 or 7 years ago. Yeah, about 6 or 7 years ago. I had this weird idea that I was going to grow carnivorous plants.
Okay.
On my bases.
Oh.
And the reason that I chose carnivorous plants is they don't take a lot of soil. They get their nutrients from other substances, like eating insects.
Yeah.
I can make a very thin substrate, right, of sphagnum moss, and then create a water reservoir within the center of my plinth that would, like, nurture this little environment, right? And I wanted to take these fantastical, like, elements that I had sculpted and made, and then have the moss and all the plants grow up out of it, right? And it was really cool. Except it made me really sad because I just saw how bad my natural basing was.
Right? Okay.
And there was, like, this clear delineation between what was man-made and what was grown.
Oh.
And I have literally spent the last 7 years in pursuit of creating that natural realism.
Okay. So
eventually I can take this real thing and put it with my realistic thing and have you question which one is which. If I could make it a unicorn project, I would just blow it up, right? I'd go from a small 1/24 scale feathered Deinonychus, like a dinosaur diorama, to a full scale, like, one-to-one of the same thing.
That would be really cool.
I know how to do it. I know how to make the base. I know how to craft the things. I know how to grow the plants. I've done all of the study. It would be so, Ryan, it would touch me so much. Can you imagine, like, having this little, like, growing living base and using, like, horticulture techniques and, like, limitation of light, and then putting it into a showcase where it's just flooded with light, and you put it in one day and it looks one way, and when you come back the next day for judging, it's flowered.
That would be insane.
I would be like, I am a wizard. And to me, that would be, like, that would be the biggest win. And so I have held this close, and I have tried and pushed, and I'm getting to a point where I'm feeling like, all right, it might be time to try again. But then, you know, I still know that there's going to be some, as an artist, I'm never satisfied with what I do.
Yep.
Because it does not look in real life the same way as it does in my head.
Yeah. No, I know that struggle. That sounds like an amazing project. And I hope that you're able to do that.
I'll definitely try. Right? Whether I succeed, that's the other thing that I've learned in this amount of time since mm-hmm. I first came up with this, is that, like, you just got to try. You got to try and fail and then try again. I mean, people always tell me, like, oh, I love your resin casting. I love the water effects that you do. You do mm-hmm. such beautiful water. How did you get that good? And I tell them, I made so many horrible bases, so many bad castings. Like, I would try something and it would completely fail. And then I would try something and an accident would happen and I'd get super glue into my resin and it would make yellow smoke, but yep. then it turned to fire, like fiberglass. And I'm like, oh, I just created a new way of making this, right? It is trying and failing that teaches you more than succeeding ever will teach you.
Absolutely. That's something they kind of, a lot of business advice people and entrepreneurs, they just pound that into your head. Failure is so much more valuable in the long run than success. And that's how you succeed. And it's the same for just regular painting miniatures. I mean, the way you do wet blending correctly is you screw it up a whole bunch, self-diagnose, and figure it out.
Yep.
It goes back to that conscious competence versus unconscious competence. Failure forces consciousness so that you can become competent.
Absolutely. And nothing snaps you back to reality than completely failing. Because when you're doing it, you're like, oh, I'm so good. Look at me. Mm-hmm. And I'm dancing around in front of the mirror. And then you're like, oh, my God, what did I just do? Yep. Can I take this off? Nope.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate it. Where can we find you online?
Online, you can find me on Instagram. It is at Hobby Sensei. And I don't have much of an online presence. I'm more of the come to me and talk to me. And I'll sit down and do this with you for hours. And this is what my students always gripe at me. Oh, you'd sell more class tickets if you didn't teach everyone for free.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know what? I'm an artist, but I'm a teacher. Always wanted to be a teacher. And if I call myself a teacher, then I need to make myself a resource. So anybody finds me at, like, I travel a lot. I'm at conventions. I have stores in the San Francisco Bay Area that I'm at all the time. And if you come see me, then it'll be more than just getting to show you some painting stuff. I will talk to you for hours about these little, like, things that I'm passionate about, which are these, you know, subconscious triggers.
Subconscious triggers.
Like, do you ever notice how cigarette butts never stay in the middle of a sidewalk?
That's right? True.
They roll to the cracks. They're made out of foam, right?
Yeah.
When you put that one down in the middle of your sidewalk, how many bricks goes into a European townhouse?
Oh, Jesus.
If that townhouse is hit by a shell and half of that, if let's say 75,000 bricks go into that European townhouse, if a shell hits that and half of it is destroyed, how many bricks are on the sidewalk?
Yep.
Four.
How thick is the wall? How many bricks made, brick thicknesses was the wall?
Right. 75,000 bricks in this one house. If half of it is destroyed, how many bricks are on the floor?
A lot more than I want to put on the diorama.
But you have to be able to sell them.
Yeah.
If you only put a dozen bricks down, or you make your little pile of scree slope too small, you lose everything.
So it's knowing that number doesn't necessarily mean you have to put that number down, but you need to be able to create the impression that number exists spread out all over the place.
That's right. Convincingly conveying the volume, right? Putting dust on top of a brick pile. What's the difference between putting dust on the top of the brick pile or at the bottom of the brick pile? How long it's been since that building collapsed.
Okay, that makes sense.
Because all of the small particles are going to filter down to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it doesn't take a lot of time, but it does take some time. If all of their, you know, if everything is powdered with your weathering powders, and you've got all that fine dust on top of those bricks, but you make it look like everything's been ruined and destroyed forever, you just mess that up.
It doesn't make any sense now.
Yeah, and it's a small detail. You don't even think about it because you're like, last thing to go on is the dirt.
Right.
Right? So, like I said, hours.
Yeah, I'm gonna find you at Fort Wapple if you're at Adepticon and ask you some questions.
Absolutely, I'd love to.
Awesome. Well, I want to say thank you again for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come on to the miniature podcast and answer all my silly questions. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. I really enjoyed it. I got to talk about some stuff I was super passionate about and hopefully introduce some new concepts to people.
I think you absolutely did. I hope you enjoyed the interview. If you'd like to check any of Seth's work or any of the links mentioned in this episode, check the episode description. These episodes are recorded live on my Twitch channel, twitch.tv/uselesswizard. If you'd like to catch a live recording, we'd love to have you. Go ahead and give us a follow on my Twitch channel, that way you'll be notified the next time we go live. If you do show up to a live recording, you'll be able to participate in the question and answer sessions that we have with our guests. If you'd like to support the podcast, the best way you can do that is either share this episode with a friend, or give us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you're listening on. Shares and reviews really do help get the podcast out there to more people, and we greatly appreciate it. If you'd like to keep up with what I'm working on, go ahead and give me a follow on Twitter and Instagram under Useless Wizard. Until next time, remember that painting is good for the soul.